Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 27th of May, 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Well, I suppose we should get on straight on with the news of the day, and that is that Nigel Farage is a hero once again, Patrick, just as he was in 2016, where he declared that Brexit was a done deal and then ran away from politics. He came back and he's done it again. He's a hero. So let's just have a look at the results here. So this is the numbers of MEPs. Now, these figures are still changing slightly because Scotland is still reporting its results and Northern Ireland hasn't reported it at all yet. But so far, the Brexit Party, 28 MEPs, 15 for the Lib Dems, 10 for Labour, 7 for Green, 3 for the Tory Party, 1 for Plaid Cymru, and 3 for the SNP. Whether that'll change remains to be seen. Well, if we look at how the parties have swung, it's bad news for the Tory party, bad news for UKIP, because UKIP's vote has all gone to the Brexit party, to the charismatic Nigel. So as you can see there, UKIP down 24.2%. They have not managed to get a single MEP for themselves. It's just Brexit MEPs. But of course, the narrative from the BBC is what you would expect. They're basically saying that, well, if you count up the number of votes for the Brexit party and you count up the number of votes between the Lib Dems and the Greens, who, of course, represent those that want a second referendum, that in fact there's a bigger number of people would like to see a second referendum on this issue compared to the number of people that are hardline Brexit.
If we go back to that graph, Mike, for a minute, what's really telling you is look at the Tories. And if you add up the loss of the UKIP bloc to I would imagine, Mike, would you agree with me that there would be a number of Tory defectors in that surge in the Brexit party?
That is the case, and quite a number. I mean, Anne Whittingham, for example, stood and ended up getting a seat. Of course, a long-time Tory MP herself. But moved across to the Brexit party. There are a few others did that as well. Many of the people that had been UKIP MEPs moved over to the Brexit party as well. So the question is, as has already been expressed in the chat box, the question is, will Nigel Farage do to the Brexit party what he has managed to do to UKIP, which is to completely destroy it? But in the meantime, of course, he's saying that he may get Brexit party candidates to stand in any future general election should Britain not have left the European Union by the 31st of October, which, of course, is the current leave date, assuming that you don't believe that in fact, legally, we left on the 29th of March.
Let me guess what the memo is at Brexit Party Central, Mike. Could the memo this morning be everybody go on vacation?
If this stays true to form, that's exactly what the memo is going to be, because, of course, this is what happened over the years with UKIP many times. But in the meantime, quite a number of people discussing the BBC's coverage of the whole thing began, I think, at about 10 o'clock last night and ran through to 3 in the morning. And this is a headline from the Mail. Furious viewers slam BBC's biased Euro election coverage and that focused on Lib Dems and Greens rather than Brexit party win and allowed Alistair Campbell to accuse Farage of taking Russian money. Well, it wasn't just Farage that he accused. He made this accusation several times, including to Mr. Tice, who's the chairman of the Brexit party, who also got a seat. But as you can see the quote here on screen, you've had the rubles, all the rubles coming in. So the allegation from Alistair Campbell is more Russian election meddling. What do you make of that?
Well, just on a side note, Alistair Campbell also has I think it's a newspaper that you'll see in every newsagent and every supermarket in Britain called the EU Observer or something like that. This is one of his brainchilds. So where does the money come from to publish and distribute a newspaper like that that's in every single supermarket in the country, Mike?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question.
So that's what Alistair Campbell is doing. So clearly he's still with Tony Blair in that vein. But what's just a final comment, Mike, on the European elections. So the if you look at the European-wide playing field, the EPP European blocs and the Social Democrats lost their overall majority, Mike. So this is a huge sea change, not just what you saw in Britain from the surgence of the Brexit Party and the sort of demise of the Tories and the others. In Europe, it's a complete shift. So that's very, very significant.
And perhaps unsurprising, Macron has done pretty badly, and Marine Le Pen seems to have benefited from that. But do you think this is a response to what's been going on with the Elvest protests and so on?
This is just an overall trend. So the Eurosceptics are now in the ascendancy in Brussels right now. So what's this going to mean in the future? This is going to be very interesting. How is this going to play out on the streets of Europe? If there is an economic calamity, this type of trend is only going to increase. If there's any sort of migrant crisis clashes again, this is also going to help increase this trend as well. So it's certainly very interesting. I think we've hit a watershed moment, Mike. In European politics.
Just to clarify, the Alistair Campbell publication is The New European.
The New European, that's it, yeah.
Well, look, sticking with election interference and allegations against Russia, let's bring this man on screen, Devin Nunes, who's, well, he's a senior member of the House Intelligence Committee, a congressman, Republican congressman, I believe, from California.
Very, very, one of the few.
Well, he's been particularly upset about Russian interference in U.S. elections. And is it Russian interference? Because this is what he had to say. He wrote to President Trump saying, "I respectfully request that you ask Prime Minister May." Now, of course, Trump coming to the U.K. In a few days' time, June the 3rd to the 5th. So while he's here, Nunes has asked him to ask Prime Minister May about the British government's knowledge of the Steele dossier and whether the British government took any unilateral actions based on information provided by Steele. Now, of course, he's talking about Christopher Steele, the so-called former MI6 officer who wrote the dodgy dossier on behalf of the Hillary Clinton campaign, which started the whole Russiagate scandal and the allegations of Russian interference in the US presidential election in 2016. He went on to say that any unilateral actions based on information provided by Steele or at the request of any U.S. departments or agencies, including but not limited to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So he said that Theresa May's... So he was basing his letter on this report from The Telegraph, which came out a week or so ago. Theresa May's spy chiefs were briefed on explosive Christopher Steele dossier before Donald Trump. And the Telegraph said that Steele, the former MI6 agent who authored this dossier, personally briefed British intelligence officials on the dossier and its contents rapidly spread up the chain as far as MI5 Director General Andrew Parker and MI6 Chief Alex Younger. And he says that the Telegraph's assertions, if true, raise important questions about the potential role of foreign government officials may have played in spreading the dossier's fake allegations and what actions they may have taken in response to the allegations. So the question here, Patrick, is this Russian interference in U.S. elections? I don't think so.
Certainly doesn't look like it. It looks like another country's interfering, Mike. But just to be clear, what started the whole Russiagate fiasco in the 2016 elections, one of the things was WikiLeaks and the DNC emails being published. That sort of got the ball rolling there. Then you had the FISA warrants, which were triggered by a British operation involving entrapping George Papadopoulos, involving Orbis Intelligence, the Dearlove Gang, Joseph Misfood, or is it Mifsud? I can't remember. Alexander Downer, Australian diplomat. And so they entrapped Papadopoulos. That helped to trigger the FISA warrants. And then the Steele dossier comes along. And the main point of the Steele dossier is to delegitimize the incoming president.
And who do we have involved in the Steele dossier aside from Christopher Steele? We've got...
Well, we've got the Clinton
Orbis. We've got
the Clinton campaign. Obviously, we've got Fusion GPS.
Dearlove.
We've got Dearlove and the Orbis gang as well. So that's a massive British contingent Stefan Halper, another British agent, if you will.
But the point is that this isn't just one incident. From what you've given a bit of the previous events, and we see the same characters involved in previous events as well.
Yeah. So the core of the gang and the activity here is British.
Right.
Basically, that's one of the common threads overlapping all of this, aside from obviously the U.S. side. So that brings up a big question, Mike. The whole idea of Russia game, and this is what we're meant to. We're all meant to sort of get this narrative kind of going and kind of jump on board with this bandwagon and really, you know, foreign interference in U.S. democracy. And it's meant to be Putin and Russia, right? This is the main talking point. But actually, it looks like Britain might be the main culprit. That's Prime Minister Theresa May. It is under her watch that this took place. This particular incident that we're talking about here, partly, you could drag David Cameron into it a little bit. It depends how far back this particular one goes. But let's say it's safely. This is a Theresa May issue.
And the British deep state.
So Britain meddled in U.S. democracy.
Absolutely.
And so will Nunes get any traction on this request? You've got a state visit coming up with the President of the United States. So I don't know if he'll be meeting with Theresa May.
He will be, absolutely.
There's not much, you know, to talk about there other than this issue probably.
Indeed, because she's got nothing else to talk to him about. She's on her way.
Interesting that she's on her way out now that all this is surfacing. Yeah. It's terribly convenient, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, let's move on. Mike Pompeo, here he is, U.S. Secretary of State. What's he been up to? This action has been taken to deter Iranian aggression and build partner self-defense capability. So what action is he talking about? Well, apparently emergency action, Patrick, because as many mainstream media have been reporting, defying Congress, according to Reuters here, Trump sets $8 billion plus weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and UAE. So this is a really pretty significant development. Pompeo saying today's action will quickly augment our partners' capacity to provide for their own self-defense and reinforce recent changes to U.S. posture in the region to deter Iran. And in this article here, it goes on to say that, quoting him again, saying Iranian malign activity poses a fundamental threat to the stability of the Middle East and to American security at home and abroad. The justification for this says that current threat reporting indicates Iran engages in preparations for further malign activities throughout the Middle East region, including potential targeting of U.S. and allied military forces in the region, and even goes on to suggest that the Houthis operating in Yemen are operating as Iranian-controlled aggressors. And this seems like a pretty incredible position to be taking.
That's an insane claim. They say the Houthis, what they're talking about is Ansarullah. Okay, these are Yemeni people. This is the largest sort of populist movement in Yemen that totally opposes this Saudi war, this U.S. and U.K.-backed Saudi war. And they're fighting a war of resistance against an imperial neighbor who is trying to basically bomb Yemen back into the Stone Ages. So the way the mainstream media is saying that the Houthis are operating, okay, they're not Iranian-backed, they're not Iranian proxies, they are Yemeni. Okay, they might have some tertiary support from Iran and other allies, like any country would in this situation, but there's a full blockade on Yemen. So, I mean, Iran doesn't have a secret tunnel to get in there. So they're literally stitching things together and, tying bits and bobs, running a MacGyver resistance, basically. And they're doing extremely well against a well-equipped Saudi Arabian military that has the full backing of the United States. So this will end up being Saudi's kind of mini Vietnam, as it were, by the end of it. And they're losing the war. They may end up losing this lock, stock. We'll see. But the U.S. involvement in it is just beyond, even after it's been exposed. There's plenty of pushback for it. But this Trump administration is holding steady because Donald Trump believes that this is about business.
In the chat box, Tam there saying that Mike Pompeo's lost the plot, picked up a Mossad handout by mistake. Is that a fair assessment of the words that Pompeo's been using?
We'll get to that in a minute, but let's just move on swiftly here. So this is the other end of this story here. So Trump bypasses Congress to push through the arms sale. So how did he manage to engineer this? Well, let's look at the Trump administration cites what it claims is a national security, quote, emergency, supposedly caused by Iran. Okay, we no specifics there, but in order to bypass Congress and push through this $8 billion arms deal for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and their allies. So the whole thing is predicated on an Iranian threat, which is based on intelligence. Mm-hmm. So let's look at that for a minute. So when we say Trump administration, in this case, we're talking about these two people, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton, who are cooking up something here. We're not sure exactly what it is, but we do have an idea now. This is actually from 2 weeks ago, Gareth Porter revealing John Bolton's nefarious plot for a war in Iran. And what do we discover through this analysis, through this reporting, is that the source of this intelligence, Mike, we mentioned this last week, the source of this intelligence is actually, guess where? It's Israel. Israel is supplying the secret intelligence for this alleged Iranian threat that's triggering this emergency measure in Congress so that Trump can sell another $8 billion in arms to the Saudis. Really? Well, yes, it was confirmed by Axios. Israel passed White House intelligence on possible, I quote, possible Iran plot. So the whole thing is a complete made-up kind of situation. So this is unbelievable. This is the thing that Donald Trump campaigned against in 2016. Mm. And here he is presiding over just the worst kind of destabilization policies and really exacerbating a really bloody and violent war in the Middle East and threatening to trigger a wider war with Iran. So what I'm going to say is, Donald Trump, why don't you just go for it, have a sex change, and embrace being Hillary Clinton? Because if we wanted a warmongering stooge, they would have elected Hillary to do the job, Donald.
Well, there is one voice or several voices of reason in the United States. This is the War on the Rocks website, and on Friday they published this, an open letter to President Donald Trump on U.S. tensions with Iran. This is letters signed by 75 retired military officers and also ambassadors, and they're saying that the lack of direct communications between U.S. and Iranian political and military leaders during a time of heightened rhetoric only increases the possibility of a miscalculation resulting in an unintended military conflict. They're maybe being a little naive, perhaps, by suggesting that any potential military conflict is unintended. But anyway, they go on to say Washington and Tehran are talking past each other and taking actions the other views as dangerously provocative at best and the beginning of forceful action at worst. We're heartened by Trump's reported desire to avoid war with Iran in favor of other tools, including common sense diplomacy, while economic sanctions against Iran have had the beneficial effect of reducing financial support for Hezbollah in Lebanon. These, as well as military threats inside Iran, have thus far proved ineffective in changing the regime's behavior. As President and Commander-in-Chief, you've considerable power at your disposal to immediately reduce the dangerous levels of regional tension. And they go on to suggest that he should take some specific action to do exactly that. So they aren't exactly viewing things necessarily with through the correct lenses. But the point is, they're really arguing that Trump needs to start behaving a bit more sensibly.
Look, he's president of the United States, and there's a fair bit of power that comes with that job. So at some point, if you're a leader and you're not leading from behind like this president is doing right now, step forward and lead, because this is what the voters elected you to do. Mm-hmm. Lead on the things that you campaigned on in 2016. Instead, Donald Trump has just bombed his base. He's bombing his base in Yemen. He's bombed his base in Syria. He keeps bombing the base. If he keeps bombing the base, he's going to end up possibly losing the base in the 2020 elections. So we'll see. It'll be a very tight race, but certainly this sort of activity doesn't necessarily help Donald Trump in retaining his base at all.
Okay, let's, well, stick with Trump in a certain sense. 17 new indictments against Julian Assange.
This is a big story that broke last week, and, well, this is a game changer, Mike. Just as we were getting our heads around the extradition process and the reviving of the Swedish sex case, possibly that hasn't actually gone through yet, but just as we were getting our head around that, then the United States Department of Justice drops this one. So they kind of had a deadline to meet, as was explained to us by Joe Loria, the editor of Consortium News on yesterday's Sunday Wire, in great detail. In fact, if you want to know anything about this story, go and listen to the Sunday Wire and the segment with Joe Loria. It's laid out in fine detail, basically. But we'll give you a little summary of where this is at. So let's have a look at some of the key points here. 17 indictments against Assange from the United States Department of Justice. Here are the key points. 10 years per indictment. That's a possible 170 years sentence. This is also addition to a 5-year charge for conspiring to commit computer intrusion with Chelsea Manning. We thought that might be enough to extradite Julian Assange a few weeks ago, but they actually had a deadline here. And a lot of this has to do, Mike, with Britain. Britain would couldn't extradite Julian Assange to a country that would just lop on a whole bunch of charges after he arrived on U.S. shores. So the deadline was June 18th. The question that Joe Loria and we were asking yesterday is why so early? Why do these indictments come so early? It might have something, Mike, to do possibly with the leadership change in Britain. I'm not sure. But you have to remember this is all going to be laid at the feet of Sajid Javid, as it stands, because he is the Home Secretary, and he will decide. So the other key point here, they're reframing this case. So these indictments contain incredibly inflated rhetoric, and they're reframing it from a journalist and a publisher to a hostile foreign intelligence service and a spy. So they're sidestepping the First Amendment in the U.S. Constitution. They're criminalizing the practice of journalism, publishing classified leaked documents, and this gives the U.S. a global jurisdiction to go after any journalist, any individual for publishing any national security items or material globally. So you have to remember, if this is the 1917 Espionage Act, then, if this is the 1917 Espionage Act, then it has to fall under a different purview with regards to publishers and journalists. So this is what they're doing here. They're splitting this apart, basically. So let's move on to the next frame, and let's have a look and see what else we have here. So the reaction, there's been some pushback from the U.S. media, from rights groups, from media watchdog groups are finally waking up about the Assange indictment. So the U.S. Department of Justice declares a war on journalism. This is essentially what it is. This is essentially what's happening. So they've had the power to do this for many years, but they haven't exercised that power. Now this is the first U.S. administration that's actually gone over that red line and has basically taken a journalist and a publication and put it into the Espionage Act frame and prosecuted or attempting to prosecute here. So now journalists, even liberal left-wing journalists, are pushing back on this in the United States. Some of the biggest names, including Rachel Maddow, one of the Russia Gator in chief of the U.S. media. She's even taken the side of Julian Assange on this, so is her colleague Chris Hayes and many others. So many people are encouraged by this. But let's look at the situation with the Espionage Act. This is Alan Rusbridger, a former Guardian editor, who's been relatively muted on this issue for quite some time. But he penned this. I'm surprised that The Guardian published this, but they're loosening their stance a little bit on this because I think The Guardian, even though it seems to be under the control of the intelligence services half the time, somebody seems to recognize that there's a serious problem here and that Britain will be snagged with the United States in the sort of court of public opinion.
Yeah, well, they did publish this from Alan Rusbridger, but Rushbridge, but they also published their editorial yesterday, which we mentioned on Sunday Wire last night, which was quite the opposite.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But the point is, in which Russ Bridger brought up here, is the Espionage Act. When it was passed, it's a World War I era piece of legislation. It's actually based on the British Official Secrets Act. But it was a panic measure, as described here by Russ Bridger, to clamp down on sedition. So Julian Assange is not American. WikiLeaks is not a U.S.-based publication. So this, the reframing here is incredibly dangerous because it's about global jurisdiction. So everybody falls under U.S. laws now for sedition. This is what the United States is attempting to do here. So we'll move on and look at the next part of this. So as editor of The Guardian, I worked with Assange when we jointly, along with newspapers in the U.S. and Europe, published other material Manning had leaked. Okay, this is important. Julian Assange, who published it. So he is saying right here, Julian Assange is a publisher. Mm. So the United States is saying that he's not, WikiLeaks is not a publisher. Julian Assange is not a journalist or a publisher. That's Alan Rushbridger. Mm. So he's on the record now. So he has to defend this statement now going forward. So this is kind of interesting. And there's others like Alan Rushbridger who've stepped out and who are making some comments in support of Assange and in opposition to the U.S. administration. So this is under the sort of general heading of Trump's war on the Constitution. And that's exactly what this is. By sidestepping the U.S. Constitution, by reframing it away from protections of journalists and publishers, Trump has effectively declared war on the U.S. Constitution. What does this mean? This is a big deal, and I'll explain to you why. The Constitution of the United States explicitly states Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or the prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right people to have peaceful assembly and petition the government for redress of grievances, etc. That is explicit in our Constitution. Okay. Now, why is this being laid at the feet of Donald J. Trump? Well, Donald Trump took an oath when he was inaugurated in 2017, bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. He said, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And with this action by the DOJ, they are attacking the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. That means that this president is in violation of his oath. Mm. If he's going to allow this to go forward, that is either, he has two options. One is to resign, or he could be impeached on this basis. I'm not talking about fake impeachment that the Democrats have been bandying about for 2 years, looking for reasons to impeach the president. This is a clear reason. This is an open goal for impeachment. This is a huge violation. This is a historic U-turn in U.S. history that this particular president, Donald Trump, is presiding over. It's hugely dangerous, and it will transform the United States as a constitutional republic if this is allowed to stand. There should be absolute pushback from all members of the press, from both parties. This is an executive branch here that has gone over the line. This is the deep state attacking the U.S. Constitution. This is Donald Trump leading the deep state attack on the U.S. Constitution. I don't know how else to put it, but it's gravely serious.
Okay. Okay, well, let's come back to the European Union now. And, of course, the news earlier this year and towards the end of last year was this issue of the copyright directive and the implications that that has on free speech in Europe. Well, Poland has decided to issue the first strike against that. And they've submitted a complaint to the European Court of Justice, and they're saying that this law's requirement for filtering content has the potential for censorship. This would violate the Polish constitution as well as EU treaties, and so they've brought that to the European Court of Justice. Now, most of the objections to the content filtering lie around the chilling effect that it's going to have on the web, particularly with regard to people creating memes and so on, and the use of those to spread information on social media. Poland, though, is saying that this is a free speech issue, and we'll see what the European Court of Justice has to say about it. There's certainly no guarantee that they're going to agree with it, but at least one member state of the EU is pushing back against this pretty disgusting legislation.
If Poland's successful, what will that mean for the rest of the European states? Would that mean anything for Britain?
Well, it absolutely does, because Britain has said that despite the fact that we are leaving the EU, that we would implement this in any case. But it has implications globally, because, of course, whatever the EU does on this, the big global social media platforms are going to have to implement it. Or else they have to stop operating in the EU. Now, the global social media companies in general seem to be on the same page as governments with respect to shutting down free speech and so on. So I think that although the European Union is driving forward with this and taking the lead on this in terms of Article 13, which is the copyright, or sorry, the upload filter, this is something that would probably be rolled out beyond the EU. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely important that this gets challenged.
Very encouraging.
Yes.
Very encouraging.
Well, in the meantime, and maybe this is slightly encouraging as well, here's 77th Brigade. Now, what are they all about? This is the UK, the British Army's psychological operations team.
Do they work behind computers mostly?
They do. You might call them cyber and psychological operations.
And what is this man doing if he works behind a computer?
That's a very good question. I mean, one person on Twitter described them as an elite unit of hackers, propagandists and ne'er-do-wells who crawl social media to plant stories, influence opinion and generally manipulate things on behalf of government.
Sounds like CNN.
Well, indeed. It's just another string to the bow. Well, look, the Register has pushed out this article last week. British Army Cyber and PsyOps Unit 77 Brigade can't even brainwash civvies and helping it meet recruitment targets. Okay.
Wait, so, I like so the headline again. Read that again.
Brilliant headline. British Army Cyber and PsyOps Unit 77 Brigade can't even brainwash civvies into helping it meet recruitment targets. Now, the important thing about 77 Brigade is it doesn't just recruit and employ military personnel. It also recruits and employs civilians. And, of course, the head of the Integrity Initiative, Chris Donnelly, is involved with this particular group as well. So what the Register has found out through a Freedom of Information request is that basically they cannot recruit their targets into 77 Brigade, and therefore it's not being particularly effective. And that's only a good thing, in my opinion.
What a shame.
What a shame. Okay, look at this then. Here's HMS Albion leaving Plymouth. Unbelievable that there's a UK Royal Navy ship actually in Plymouth, but there you go. Where's Albion off to? The Baltic Sea, because of course we don't want to put any pressure on Russia at all. So it's off to the Baltic Sea to lead a multinational task group in support of European security. This is what the Royal Navy says. So thousands of UK Armed Forces personnel will take part in the first UK-led joint expeditionary force maritime deployment. HMS Albion is going to act as the command ship for this. This marks the first deployment of the military force, which comprises nine nations, including the UK, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Netherlands, Norway and Sweden. So this will 3,850 soldiers, marines, soldiers and airmen to take part in this deployment, along with more than 17 naval vessels in the Baltic region. Fantastic stuff. This is pressure on Russia, of course, but beyond that, this is all about European security. So we began the program with Brexit. We're going to end the program with Brexit effectively, because, of course, what we're showing here is that whether we have Brexit or not, Britain is leading this multinational task force. Let's come back to what Jean-Claude Juncker said some time ago. Europe needs to move from the current patchwork of bilateral and multilateral military cooperation to gradually increase defence integration. He's talking about defence union, of course. And when we look at the EU, Defence Union diagram that they have kindly provided, the Pantheon here on the left-hand side. Now, remember, what they say about this diagram is that EU Defence Union cannot happen unless all pillars are in place. So if bilateral and multilateral cooperation amongst member states is not in place, then you cannot have Defence Union. The point is that this is a key part of the infrastructure, and the Joint Expeditionary Force, which is heading off to the Baltic today, is a key part of that as well.
Yeah, this will be interesting to see how the EU Defence Union conversation develops after now we have this result in the European elections. Will the Brexit Party candidates be talking or raising this issue? Because we know that it's actually off limits in Westminster.
Well, look, this is a very good point. I just want to mention that because Nigel Farage, of course, has consistently refused to talk about EU Defence Union. When he's challenged on this, he starts talking about EU Army. And the point that we keep making is that there is no EU Army. There's not going to be. They're not building an EU Army. What they're doing is creating a defence union. So all the national militaries become focused under one centralised command and control structure. This doesn't mean the EU will have its own army. It'll have its own command and control, which is a different thing completely. Now, the importance of that is that, of course, if you focus on the term EU Army and you end up writing to the Ministry of Defence about this, they can legitimately say there is no agreement in the EU for an EU Army and they're not building an EU Army. So Farage, by focusing on the idea of an EU Army, in fact, diverts people away from the from what this is, which is defence union, in the same way that the EU is building other unions, a tax union, a fiscal union, and the other union structures that will eventually create this federalist state that they're building.
So the point to remember is if you use the term EU Army when you're writing your representative, that letter will go in the bin.
Correct.
But if you use the proper term, which is EU Defence Union, that is real policy, and then that has to be responded to.
Correct. And Nigel Farage should be a key target for making those inquiries.
Absolutely. So.
Okay. Look, we're pretty much out of time, Patrick. But do you want to mention this briefly?
Well, this story sort of came up in the this came up in the New York Times. What is it? UFOs? The United States Navy is reporting UFOs. So this is just bizarre. And people probably saw this. You've got a comment on this, Mike, which is really interesting. So this is making the rounds on social media. And this is a pilot here who's basically saying, we're seeing UFOs off the coast of the Atlantic. And so this is the claim. This is Ryan Graves, lieutenant, naval pilot here. Strange objects appearing in the sky. Things are out there all day. This is a Super Hornet pilot here, and it's basically keeping an aircraft in the air requires a significant amount of energy. These spinning cones are up for 11 and 12 hours at a time, Mike. What's this about, Mike?
Well, this is a very good question. Look, it's about the fact that the History Channel is about to... So it's basically an advertisement for a History Channel documentary series.
This is an advertisement in the New York Times.
Absolutely.
To pump up a new documentary on the History Channel.
That's exactly it. And of course, we're seeing more and more of this type of thing. Did the History Channel pay for this article? I think it's highly likely they did. But the point is that it is not labelled as an advertisement. The legislation in the UK and Europe at least says that if you're putting an infomercial in your publication, you've got to label it clearly as being an advertisement. This is not labelled as an advertisement. It's labelled as an editorial piece. And so is this the level that the New York Times has fallen to, that they have to pretend to be writing their own journalism on subjects like this, when in fact it's probably a placed story?
Well, they're advising all the fake news policing services like NewsGuard and on the First Draft Coalition. The New York Times is one of the main...
Right.
Partners in the fight against fake news, and yet we see this sort of thing where they're blatantly pushing around its marketing, basically,
right,
for paid marketing, actually. So interesting.
The fall of the free press. But anyway, we have to leave it there because we're right out of time. Thank you very much for joining me today, Patrick. Thank you for joining us. We will be back as usual at the same time, 1 p.m. on Wednesday. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.